Welcome to the Motorcycle Vagabond Show. We've got Paul and Andrea today in a podcast that we're going to call Motorcycles, Hope, Recovery, Love, and More Motorcycles. So, Andrea, tell me why the podcast is going to be named this.
Well, it started with two people that are extremely passionate about motorcycling, that use motorcycling in different aspects, including touring, racing, off-road, dirt, dual sport. I think that includes all the motorcycling.
Adventure
riding. It's like no matter what it is, we just can't get enough of motorcycles. And we both have been involved in motorcycling. I'll speak for myself, my entire life, pretty much. Starting with my father, who his first bike that I can remember, he had bikes prior, but the first one I remember was a Kawasaki back in the 70s. And as a family, we would all pile on that same bike, my mom, my brother, my dad, and myself. I'd sit on the gas tank and we would ride around in the little town we lived in. So it was just natural to progress. And there was never a gender issue in my family growing up. If you want to do it, you're interested, you're doing it. So motorcycling was a sport for my brother and for myself. He got a bike before me when he was a few years older. I think I was 9 years old when he got his little Suzuki RM80, and I'd ride on the back with him, and eventually I learned how to ride on that bike, and I wanted my own. So I think I was 11 years old. My dad brought home the classified papers and said, okay, if you want a bike, you got to start calling all these people. They were selling a bike and find yourself a bike. So I did, and that would have been in the early 80s, I think, probably. And I found a little Suzuki 80 myself, and I rode that in my little neighborhood with all my friends, and it was a blast. And then the older I got, the more I wanted to ride more and on the street. And through a series of circumstances, my dad ended up with my uncle's 1972 Harley-Davidson Sportster, and I asked my dad one day, I'm like, Dad, can I ride that? I was 17 years old. I said, can I ride that on the road? And he said, if you can kick it and it'll start, you can ride it. So I did. I kicked it. And on a third try, it started, and his eyes got really big, and he ran next to me on the alley we lived on just to make sure I'd be okay, and I rode it. He said, okay, let's go get your mom and go for a real ride. So we did, and that's when I really started riding on the road.
That's really awesome. I love seeing motorcycles as part of the family.
Oh, it certainly is. In fact, I mean, I could go on and on. My mom and I have matching bikes now. We both have 1998 Russian Urals. The sidecar. Actually, mine's a 98. I think hers is a little newer, but we ride together, my mom and I. It's fun. And my dad has a sidecar on his Moto Guzzi, and I started getting into rallies. My first rally I went to for Moto Guzzi was in 1990. I think it was 93-ish. And I took that Harley Davidson to the rally. And it was in Ohio. It was an Ohio rally, and it was fun. You know, you pack your camping gear on the bike and go and camp. And Moto Guzzi allows anybody to come to their rallies. You don't have to be a Moto Guzzi brand to show up. And then my next rally was in 1999, and I started going regularly. Actually, it was kind of hit and miss. And then after 2004, I pretty much hit all the rallies, as many as I can in the summer. And I didn't buy my first Moto Guzzi until 2010. So I used to take I bought a brand new Sportster back in 2000, and I rode that for a couple years. I didn't really care for it. It was an 883. And then I bought a Triumph after that, which I still have, Speedmaster. And that's a fun bike. I ride it still. I try to get on it once a year. But usually I ride my Moto Guzzi Vossa is probably my favorite bike that I ride.
So, if I understand correctly, motorcycles have helped you through some dark times.
They have. So, those were some good times. Rallies and friends and riding. That was all good times. And then in 2013, I started getting a series of headaches, and I had some other strange symptoms that were happening that I was just ignoring that, you know, it shouldn't be that important, but I couldn't ignore them anymore. So, I went to the emergency room, and they said, oh, you've got a brain tumor, and we're going to have to take it out, like, right now. So they did. And after that, you know, I couldn't walk or Well, I had to learn to walk again, and I could walk. I just had to learn to do it again and learn a bunch of things. So it took me several years to get normal again. But that following spring, so that was in June of 2013. That following spring, I actually got out of my Triumph and rode it again. I didn't know if I'd be able to, but that's my lightest weight bike at the time. Probably the easiest to maneuver for me because my balance was really off after having my brain cut. And I went for a ride. My daughter rode with me, which probably was sort of stupid, but she wanted to go. Mm-hmm. So we went for a ride, and I thought, wow, I think I can ride again. So I started riding again, and it was very healing. One thing I never lost through all of that was the mechanics of motorcycling, because you know how your body feels when you're doing it. It's like ingrained. It's just there with you forever. So no matter what my brain has gone through, I always remained able to motorcycle and to feel the bike and lean it properly and ride it like I always have. And that felt really good to me because there are other things I couldn't do, like remember. My short-term memory just got smoked from that brain surgery. So that was like a good escape for me with motorcycling.
Made you feel normal?
It did. It still makes me feel normal because I might not be. Not normal. So,
well, you still have a brain tumor, don't you?
Yeah, so that was in 2013 that I had the first one removed, and it was deadly at the time, I guess. So the second one they discovered in 2015, because now I get routine brain scans. So 2 years later, they said, oh, you have another one, and actually it was there before, but it was so small we overlooked it, and it grew big enough to see it, and they ended up they're just watching it. And then I changed my diet in 2016, and it hasn't grown in 4.5 years.
What did you change your diet to that helped it stop growing?
I can tell you it's extremely complicated. What's really complicated about it is motorcycling and, like, camping with it. But we found ways to work with it. I cannot have any animal protein. The goal is to keep my body alkaline because illness has a hard time growing in an alkaline body. Tumors, cancer, or illness in general thrives in acidic pH bodies. So you want to typically keep it balanced so it's alkaline. And animal products cause your body to become acidic. So like milk, dairy, eggs, all of that, I don't eat any of it.
So you'd be like vegan?
No, because I would say more like pescatarian. So I can have fish. And I do eat shrimp, and I would eat mussels, different things like that. I'll eat scallops. Cannot have beef, chicken, pork, lamb, any of that kind of stuff.
Or sugar.
Oh, no cane sugar. I can't have any sugar. I can have maple syrup or malted barley or rice syrup. I cannot have cane sugar. So I cook all my own food pretty much. Not as much as I used to because it hasn't grown in so long that I think I'm pretty alkaline. I test myself every once in a while. I've been remaining alkaline. So I have to stay away from all that stuff. And there are certain vegetables I have to stay away from too. So it's not all vegetables. Like nightshade vegetables, they have a chemical in them that can cause me to become a little acidic. So tomatoes, eggplant, whatever nightshade vegetable is, white potatoes, I can't have those.
So if you were to be back on a regular diet, would the tumor grow and you'd have to have another surgery?
I think the tumor would grow, but it's small enough that I could probably have what's called the gamma knife, which is just a giant dose of radiation. It's like 180 beams of radiation centralized at one location to sear the tumor away from its feeding supply, and it'll just die. So that would be the next step. I don't want invasive brain surgery ever again.
That sounds pretty miserable, you know, pretty much ruining everything you can do now and having to relearn it.
Yeah, that was tough. That was not easy. I think the hardest part about all of that was my memory and my language. Like, I would see something and think I'm saying that's the correct thing, and it's not. Like, oh, there's such and such. You know, I sell Mack trucks for a living, and I would see a truck and think that was a certain customer, and my boss was like, no, that's not them. So I knew what I was thinking, and it just won't come out my mouth the correct way. That's been my biggest struggle, I'd say.
Do you still have those issues?
No, not as much. Every once in a while, that whole we make fun of myself for those little forks, but I say things I don't even realize I'm saying sometimes. But Paul didn't know me then, so he doesn't know it as different. So he's okay with it. I think.
Speaking of Paul, you've got your own story of how motorcycles have gotten you through dark times.
Oh, yeah. I was a little bit different from Andrea. I didn't grow up riding. My parents didn't let me have a motorcycle when I was a little kid. I would say it was when we were living in Savannah, Tennessee. So it would have been somewhere between age 6 and 9 or age 5 and 9. My dad went to a motorcycle dealership and he talked to the salesman. He said, I'd really like to buy a motorcycle, and he had my brother and I with him. And I guess the salesman did what salesmen do. You know, they try to determine what type of bike the customer wants. And dad basically said, well, you know, I've never ridden a motorcycle. I don't know anything about them. And the salesman looked at dad and said, are these your two kids? And dad said, yeah, he goes, out buy a motorcycle. So he talked my dad out of buying a motorcycle. And so, you know, the danger factor. And so my dad didn't let us have motorcycles growing up. And, you know, my friends had motorcycles and dirt bikes and stuff. If my parents weren't around, I'd ride those. But when I turned 18, 19 and left the house, the leaving the house teenage rebellion thing, the first thing I did is bought a motorcycle, and I found a 1972. Go ahead.
No, I'm just laughing. That's awesome.
Oh, I bought a 1972 Kawasaki H2750. I don't know if you remember those. They were the 3-cylinder 2-stroke, and I joke all the time that it's a wonder the thing never ran right, because it was a brutally fast bike. And I think the one time it did run right, I wrecked it. And it was a bad wreck, and it never came back together after that. And so from then on, motorcycles played some part in my life, you know, whether it was the street bike. I did a little bit of motocross. I did hair scrambles. And I think in Waverly, Tennessee, when I lived there, I think I went one whole year that I didn't even have a vehicle. I just drove a motorcycle. I didn't care how cold it was. And then, you know, I had a few rough patches in life, and the cure was getting on a motorcycle and going for rides. You know, it seems like the faster you go, the further you get away from them. And then in 2009, I got bit by a tick, and I didn't know anything about Lyme disease. I was really unfamiliar with tick-borne illnesses, other than in Tennessee, you get Rocky Mountain spotted fever. You know, that kind of thing is pretty common knowledge, but In the 2000s, Lyme disease wasn't as well known as other tick-borne diseases. And so in 2009 started a gradual decline. I think it was probably 2011 or 12, I just started selling motorcycles, because doctors had diagnosed me with different things, from MS to I don't remember, all kinds of stuff. They were giving me diagnoses that weren't accurate. But I developed memory issues, cognitive issues, balance issues. And, you know, one of the things that was difficult was my brain was like a half second behind reality. And so, you know, if I was coming up to a vehicle, I would get dangerously close to the back bumper before I stopped, you know, and then I'd get my feet down. I'd do a panic stop, get my feet down, and I'd struggle with balance. And so I'd talk to the doctor about that. And they, at that time, I think they were telling me they thought it was Lou Gehrig's disease or something. I don't remember. And so he basically said, you know, I think you should stop riding motorcycles, and, you know, led me to believe that motorcycles probably wouldn't play a very important role in my life, if any at all, from there forward. And so I sold all my motorcycles except for one. I kept a 1972 Husqvarna CR250, and I sold my beloved Moto Guzzi California 2. And at that time, too, it was difficult to work. I was self-employed, and so I was just, you know, struggling with trying to have the energy, the cognitive abilities to perform my work, which was landscape construction and design. And so I focused on trying to figure out what was wrong. And in 2013, I was on a job, and it was a long job, a design and construction job. And when it was over and I was going through the, you know, final processes, guiding the customer through how to use, like, their landscape lighting and all that other stuff, the customer, Fiona, said, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions, personal questions? And I'm like, no. And she said, you know, do you struggle with fatigue? Do you struggle with random joint pain, phantom pains? You know, all these questions. And I answered yes to all of them. She goes, I think you have Lyme disease. And I said, well, you know, I talked to my doctor about that. And my doctor said that it's often, you know, misdiagnosed and that, you know, I didn't have it. And so she said, you know, go see so-and-so doctor and ask for an Igenics test and ask for a CD57 and, you know, let me know what they say. And so I went to the doctor and I told the doctor, you know, what my issues were and said that, and I was pulling 5 or 6 embedded ticks off of me a month. And so either 1 in 3 or 2 in 3 ticks in New Hampshire, which is where I lived at that time, carried Lyme disease. And so she said, well, I'm just going to give you a clinical diagnosis. You've got Lyme disease, but we're going to run some tests and see what happens. And she said it'd probably take about 3 weeks for the test to come back. She told me in 8 days. She goes, you got Lyme disease. She goes, it's there. And so at that time, I was like thrilled. I finally got a diagnosis. You know, we can knock this thing out and then get back to life again. I didn't understand that. Not only is Lyme disease hard to diagnose, it's very difficult to treat. And at that time, I had had it for 4 years, and it had really taken its toll. So they started me on a treatment plan, which was pretty brutal. But within a couple of years, I kind of started getting back things that I'd lost, like balance and things like that. And so I bought a Buell. I think I bought a Buell Blast. I can't remember. I bought a Buell, and then I bought something else, and then I bought something else, and then I bought something else, and then...
It was an addiction.
It was an addiction, yeah. But it's not cured. You know, I still suffer from a lot of joint pain, a lot of muscle pain, a lot of cognitive issues, a lot of neurological issues, damage was done. And then the treatment itself caused even more damage. So I have a special diet that I have to follow too. And so, you know, for me, getting on a motorcycle was like the great equalizer. You know, if I could ride a motorcycle, I felt like I was cured. It didn't make a difference if when I got home, you know, I could barely get off of it, or if I stopped somewhere to eat, I had to eat something special, you know. And if you're on a bike with a bunch of other guys, you're all the same, you know. And so it made me feel normal in that sense. And then I had my first spine surgery in 2015. Some of the issues that I've been struggling with Lyme turned out that we attributed to Lyme turned out to be an 80% impingement on my spinal cord. And so in 2015, I had my first spine operation, and I left that spine operation feeling like $1 million, because it had been years, you know, since I had not felt intense pain from that. And so the one caveat is the doctor said I couldn't wear a helmet for a year. You know, don't ride a motorcycle, don't ride a four-wheeler, don't ride a snowmobile for a year. And so after, I think, like 8-9 months, I was feeling pretty good, and I pulled out my 1918 Mako 250, and I cranked that thing up, and I ripped up and down the road on it a few times. I'm like, holy shit, this feels good. And then the next month, they had a air scramble called the Rock Crusher, and like a ding-dong, I entered it in too well. I wrecked in the first lap. Then two more spine surgeries followed after that, and the last one was in April of 2017, and I told the doctor that, you know, I fully intended to get back on a motorcycle again, and I'd like to get back into racing dirt. And he's like, I don't think it's a good idea. And he wouldn't sign a release for me to race dirt. And so I started looking at road racing or other forms of motorcycle racing, and I got on Craigslist. I was actually on Craigslist trying to find a smaller CC bike to go back and do the rock crusher on. And I ended up finding one of the Spanish bikes, not a Bultaco. But I talked to a guy named Paul Lynch, and I was telling him, you know, my dilemma is that I needed a smaller CC bike to do this hair scramble on because I didn't have the upper body strength or the abilities to handle a bigger bike like that off-road. And he said, have you ever thought about road racing? I'm like, no. And he's like, well, I just happen to know a guy named Henry, and he's got a Rielu, which is also a Spanish bike. He goes, USCRA, which is United States Classic Racing Association out of New Hampshire, he goes, they have a 50cc class, you know, a 70cc class. He goes, that would be a good intro to road racing. And you don't have the issues with impact, you know, like you do with off-road. And so I rode down to Connecticut, and I bought a 50cc Riehu from Three Cyphers, and 2 months, I think April, May, June. Yeah, 2 months after my last spine surgery, I joined USCRA, and I took my first road race on a 50cc two-stroke Riehu, and it was a blast. So that was like a major step for me because I felt like I had a lot of limitations racing off-road, and even had some limitations riding on road a little bit. I was still struggling with bigger bikes, but this little thing you could flick around, and it was, oh man, it was a lot of fun.
Sounds like it would be fun.
Yeah, so I went to USCRA and I took their race school, and I raced my first race in June, and it's just opened my eyes to a whole new world and a whole new life, and I don't feel limited on the track. You know, I feel normal. I feel good. That's where motorcycles took me in recovery.
Oh, that's amazing. How did you guys meet, though?
Well, racing. I'll let Andrew tell that. She's better at it.
So I went through a divorce. My ex-husband and I, there was no bloodbath. We just grew apart and went our separate ways. Our daughter was fully grown. She was 18 when we divorced, and I moved from the country to the city because it would be closer to my work. I'm only 2.5 miles from my job now instead of 46 miles is what it used to be. I bought an old historical home that was is the oldest home here in the neighborhood I live in that probably developed the area, because back in the early times when you would move west for the Western Reserve and you would claim a plot, you would get a whole section on a map. In those times, that was 100 acres. So my house was built in 1853. I moved into the house. There was a lot of work that needed done to the house. It's still a work in process. But it fit me. It's an acre in the city. I have a large garage with concrete floor and decent lighting for all my motorcycles. I have a kitchen. I spent a lot of time cooking, so my crazy food. So the kitchen is, I wanted a nice big kitchen, which is the nucleus of this home, which I have. So it just fit the bill. I love it. But I was exhausted from doing all the work on the house, like different remodel projects, and learning a lot about power tools, let me tell you. I didn't know I could actually cut a miter myself, but I can. My daughter helped me because she lives with me also full-time. Well, she's going to college now, but so she helped me on a lot of the projects, and that was kind of fun. My family pitched in, and I was still kind of depressed because I was with my ex for 21 years, and that was a big change, moving from my dream house that I had for 20 years to some house in Akron that needs all this work. So a friend of mine up in Maine and the Moto Guzzi Club I belong to suggested I fly down to see a friend of ours in Daytona, Florida, who has a Moto Guzzi flat track race team. And I know they're good friends of mine. And he said, well, just come down for a weekend, get away, do something crazy. You know, you're just working on your house all the time. So he and his girlfriend were down there. So I flew down to Daytona, And my friends picked me up from the airport, and I hung out with them for the weekend, and we went to the races, and they were just a blast. And from that moment, because he rented the track the next day, and I got to ride his Moto Guzzi 650 on the dirt track, on the flat track. After that moment, I knew I had to buy something that I can ride in dirt. I'm like, man, I street ride, but dirt riding, it's just going to double the size of my map. So I went to the races, and I met some people, and they asked, oh, what kind of bikes do you have? And I was telling them I have this Russian Ural because I have, you know, after I had my daughter, I wanted her to ride with me in the sidecar, and we got ice cream all the time. And they said, have you ever watched sidecar racing? And I said, no. And they said, well, you should watch it sometime. It's pretty amazing. And the guy I was talking to actually is a sidecar passenger. So he suggested I go, and he said, there's a race. That was in January of 2021 when I met him. He said, there's a race in February in by Savannah, Georgia. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll probably be there. I don't think he was there.
No,
he didn't. He ended up not going. He said, but you should go there, and you can watch the races. I'm like, oh, I'll have to check my schedule. So I look at my schedule. I'm like, man, I have nothing going on. So I told my daughter, hey, I'm going to fly down to Georgia. I want to watch sidecar racing because after everything I went through, you only die once. And while I'm alive, I'm going to live it. So I took my backpack, and I put a sleeping bag and a tent in it, and I flew down to Savannah by myself, got off the airplane, took a cab, well, it was a Lyft, actually, to Roebling Road Racetrack. I didn't know anything about racing at all. I'd never seen a race except for the flat track race. Oh, I did go to the drag strips a couple times.
Yeah, you didn't know anyone there.
I did not know anybody there at all. They dropped me off at the gate. I walked in. I paid to get in. I walked around, so I recognized some people I saw on Facebook. They didn't even know me. They have a Moto Guzzi with a sidecar. And I asked them if I could kind of hang out with them, and they said, sure. They were really friendly. I put my tent up right next to them. And we ended up, some of the other sidecar racers were there, and we had some spirits that night and made friends. And then the weather took a turn for the worse. I took my little one-person tent, and I went to bed. I don't know what time it was. It doesn't matter. The temperature dropped tremendously. It was freezing. I looked at the weather before I left, so I snow ski in the wintertime, so I took all my ski gear. I had my ski parka, stocking cap, gloves, mittens, everything, long underwear. I put all of it on and crawled into my sleeping bag, freezing. And then I woke up about 3 in the morning, shivering so hard I actually cracked a tooth. I put my hands down, like, between my knees to try to stop shivering, and I realized that I was soaking wet because it started raining. And Savannah, Georgia, or wherever we were, Pooler, Georgia, I think it is very flat, and my tent was flooded.
I think it rained an inch and a half that night or something.
It felt like it was probably 6 inches in my tent.
Yeah.
It was quite a bit.
All right, so let me go back.
Okay.
Let me go to where I came in. So, or right how I got there. So I had the same, a similar experience. Went through a divorce. Was still going through a divorce. In fact, we had the last court date on my way to Roebling Road Raceway from New Hampshire. I stopped at Advance Auto Parts and crawled in my truck camper and pulled the phone up and did Zoom or whatever they did it on. You know, do it over the phone. And so we had my last court date, and I crawled out of the. I sat in the camper for a little while. And, you know, I had 2 stepkids with my soon-to-be ex-wife, and everything sucked. You know, it sucked that I wouldn't see the stepkids again because it all just fell apart. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to put my life back together. So I sat in there for a little while, and then I got in my truck and headed to Roebling Road Raceway. And I looked at the weather forecast, and it called for an inch and a half rain. I'm like, I'm going to park somewhere down the road before I get to Roebling Road, because I knew it'd be a mess there. I've raced there before. And so I spent the night, I think about a half hour from the racetrack, and I let it rain out. And then I came down there at 7 o'clock the next morning and found my way in and was setting up. I'll back up a little bit more. I've been racing sidecars since, I think, 2018. I think I bought my sidecar. Yeah, I bought my sidecar. I loaded up and left New Hampshire Christmas of 2017 and drove to Alabama and bought a sidecar project and went and put it back together, and then I raced it the following February at Roebling Road. So for me, Roebling Road is a special raceway. I love, it's my favorite track, 9 turns. It's fast. But it was the first place I'd ever raced a sidecar. And so that sidecar I sold. And the first year of COVID was, what, 2020?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So I sold it. I bought another sidecar. I raced it at Laguna Seca. I raced at Laguna Seca in Kershaw, South Carolina, and then I came back and I took it completely apart thinking that I would go through it, and then COVID happened, and then I got it most of the way together, but it wasn't ready for Roebling yet, and I figured I'll just put the last few bits and pieces of it together and fire it up at Roebling. So when I pulled into the Roebling Road Raceway, I was already a day behind because I left in the middle of a snowstorm, and I should have been there Thursday, so I got there Friday, right after a horrific rainstorm, and I parked my truck and my camper, and I got out, and I let her finish, because you need to talk about where you went, concession stand.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, go for it.
Okay. So, oh, that's okay. No, that was an important spot.
Yeah.
It was flooded. It was 3:30 in the morning at this point. I cracked a tooth from shivering, so I got up out of my tent and walked up to the concession stand. And I thought, well, it's going to be cold, the concrete floor, but at least it's not wet. So I balled up in a little ball in the corner of the concession stand and tried to get go back to sleep, and which was, I don't think it happened, actually. At 7 o'clock, they opened the concession stand. People were clanking things around. I thought someone's going to walk by and kick the sleepy bag, not knowing there's a person in it. So I got up and I started walking back to my tent, and I'm walking, and I see this guy walking towards me with a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, and these dimples on his face and this smile that's a mile wide. And he looks at me and he says, good morning. And I was just talking to a group of people, I think, right before I met you.
Yeah.
So that's the moment our eyes met. That's when we said good morning to each other. And that was 7:40.
It's in my phone.
Yeah, he put it in his phone immediately so he would never forget the moment we met. So, and then I walked back over to my tent, and I was talking to a friend of mine that I just met the night before, and he said, hey, Andrea, I want to introduce you to this guy over here, this other sidecar racer. His name is Paul Kohler. So that was my official meeting to Paul. That's how we met.
That's so cool.
It was cool. So the guy that introduced us said, how'd you sleep? And I said, I didn't. I told him that I flooded, blah, blah, blah. And he said, you know, if I needed somewhere to stay, I had quite a few offers of somewhere I could stay. And then Paul said, if you want, I can clean my race trailer out. There's a spot in there. I have a cot. You can sleep in the race trailer.
Put a heater in there.
I'll put a heater in there for you. He didn't want to be a creep. and invite me into his camper. So I took him up on it. I ended up staying there all weekend, actually, with him.
Yeah, so I was walking towards concessions because on the other side of concessions is race registration. I saw her talking to a group of people, and I stood there for a minute because I knew some of them, and she was talking about her tent got flooded, and then coming back from registration is when I saw her. She was walking by herself. I'm like, oh, she's cute.
You did say that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To myself.
I think you said it later to me.
Oh, I did say it later.
Yeah.
I told you you were kissable.
Yes, he did tell me I was kissable.
Aww.
Pretty early on, actually, that day.
Yeah.
So.
So I never got my sidecar going that weekend. It was like one effing fiasco after another. And so we got to spend the whole weekend together, and I explained racing to her and sidecar racing. And, you know, when you go race, especially with a sidecar, you don't have time to socialize a lot. You know what I'm saying? Especially if there's an issue that you're working on. So I spent most of the weekend working on it. You know, Friday and Saturday I spent working on it. I didn't make practice Friday. I'm like, well, maybe I'll get it going Saturday, make Saturday practice and race Saturday. By Saturday it wasn't going. I'm like, F it. I'm done. You know, I'm just going to enjoy the weekend with Andrea. And so we had a blast, you know, all Saturday evening and Sunday we ran around and talked to people and watched racing and
went on a date. He took me out.
Oh, we went and ate sushi.
Yeah, we had sushi together. The
oh,
best
yeah.
part, are you talking about
I eat weird.
Yeah. We think alike. So I go into his truck camper and he's telling me how strange he eats, and he doesn't know me yet. He doesn't know how strange I eat. Like, I packed my food with me and took it on the airplane. Like, I had kale with me and brown rice because that's what I eat a lot. So he's like, I have strange things in my pants, in my cooking pantry, like urine and rice vinegar. And I'm looking at him. I'm like, I have all, everything you said, I have that same stuff in my house. He's like, you do? I said, I eat very strange also. So that was kind of nice to know, because a lot of people don't understand it. You know, it's foreign. When you're out, you can just go buy something somewhere. We can't. So we went out, we found a sushi place because we can both have that. So mm-hmm. we went to Buller and I rode with him in his truck and we ate, and it was a fun date.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. So then that was February, and then I dropped her off at the airport Sunday afternoon.
Which I was surprised, because I was going to just get another lift. And he's like, I'll take you to the airport. And I'm like, really? He's like, heck yeah. So he drove me to the airport.
And she left her business card in my sink.
Yeah. So he would make sure to call me.
Yeah. And we talked every day since.
Every day.
Yeah. So then the next race was in Kershaw, South Carolina, at Kershaw, CMP, Carolina Motorsports Park. And I had a passenger that was supposed to race for me, but she was training someone to do a new job. And she called me up and said, I can't, you know, I won't be able to race for a bit because I'm training. And I called Andrea and I'm like, hey, you want to be my passenger? Like, I need to know something, like, right away.
Yeah, like, right then, that very second I had to answer him.
No, I gave his name today.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that part. So I said, do you think I can do it? Because, you know, you have to be, there's a lot that goes, you have to have a few things to be a sidecar passenger, I think. I was worried about not having enough strength. I didn't know if my body could handle it. And he said, yeah, I think you could do it.
And you can't think too much.
No, you can't overthink. You don't have time to think. You have to think on the, you have to, so I think my advantage, and I think part of the reason why he asked me was I had that sidecar for my daughter.
Yeah.
And so I understand kind of the centrifugal force and how sidecar operates.
And anyone that will get on an airplane with a backpack and go somewhere that they don't know anybody and can't see is adventurous enough to get on a sidecar.
Yeah, that is true.
So she said she'd do it, and so this time I got the sidecar going before the race, and with the help of friends, like Steve Samuski and Ryan Courtney and Tom Crompton, there's a whole slew of friends came to my shop in New Hampshire. We got it all ready, and actually I'll back up a little bit, because when I left Roebling Road Raceway, you know, I dropped her off the airport, and I went to Tennessee, and I stopped at my buddy Jim's house, and I said, Jim, I met a girl. And, yeah, I described her to Jim and his wife, Sheila, and my buddy, Lenny. I told Lenny about her. And, you know, so it's like, yeah, I think we were, this is like love at first sight.
Yeah.
And, like, it was just a definite connection there, you know. And
I never had that with anybody.
Yeah, and I never intended on, like, ever having a relationship. Yeah, I was so burned, you know. And so, yeah, we talked every day after that. And so anyway, the CMP was coming up and she agreed to do it. And I said, all right, here's what we got to do. We got to get you there.
Race
school. Like, I think it was Thursday night.
Yeah.
The first race class. And then you've got race school Friday. And then Saturday is, I think we had what? Or did you go out with Dale on Saturday?
No, I raced with Dale.
Went with you. Yeah.
I never raced with Dale.
No, you rode.
I rode with him. Yeah, he was my race school teacher.
Yeah.
But you were my race pilot.
Yeah. And so then I drove from New Hampshire to Ohio, and I picked her up. She goes, oh, hey, on the way, can we go to Kentucky and get a XT250?
Yamaha.
Yeah, the one right turn. So we stopped and we stopped in Kentucky and picked up her XT and drove to Kershaw and she took race school and passenger school, sidecar passenger school, that's what it was, and did great. And then we jumped on the track, and she did excellent. I mean, the tough thing with, as a pilot, I don't know how much you know about racing sidecars, but you know, if you can imagine being on a moving platform or being on a motorcycle with a platform attached to it, and then someone literally tossing themselves either over your back or off the side of it, you know, the forces at play there. You know, if someone's jerky in their movements or they're not fluid, the pilot feels it, and it makes it much more difficult, you know, to pilot the rig. And, you know, I think that's probably my two main concerns at Kershaw were they're missing a handhold and falling off, or, you know, not understanding the centrifugal forces, and, you know, we go into a turn and she's not braced correctly and her flying off, which does happen, you know, even with seasoned pilots, that can happen. And then my other concern was, you know, she wouldn't be smooth enough, and I didn't want it to not work out. I didn't want it to not work out because, you know, naturally you want anyone that's getting on a machine like that with you to be able to properly make transitions so that you're smooth and the race is fun, but also wanted to work out because I knew I wanted to spend more time with her, you know, so.
Yeah, because you thought I was cool.
Yeah, I thought she was cool.
I thought you were kissable.
Oh, yes, and that also.
And kissable.
Cool and
yeah.
Kissable.
And some other stuff. This is G-rated, right?
Well, it depends on the show.
Okay. Yeah. You might want to put a warning on there for kids.
I usually do explicit. You guys have been remarkably good about not cussing, but there's usually more words at least.
I'm working on it. I mean, it's a bad damn habit. But.
So I passed school in that race. That was fun, but I'll tell you, nothing anybody could have ever said would prepare me for the massive force of the rig taking off on the starting grid. And it's still every time we take off from a race, that force is so incredible. I love how it feels in my body. I envy the feeling Paul must have because that GSX 1100 is underneath of his chest, and feeling all of that power underneath of his body has got to be something that's amazing.
Yeah, it's like, I don't even know how to explain. You lay on the engine. It's a fast by gas engine, Paul gas, and I don't know what it makes for horsepower, but it doesn't run on motorcycle tires. I have an 8-inch car slick in the back, a Hoosier tire on a 13-inch rim. And I mean, I lay on the engine and I'm on my knees. So you have an E-tray on each side, and it's kind of like you're in that, what's that yoga pose, prayer pose or whatever, where you're like on your knees and
cat cow.
Cat cow. You stick your butt way back and your arms in front of you.
Yeah. Oh, in front. Oh, happy.
I don't know. Yeah. Whatever,
yeah.
But downward dog or something like that. But I've got a drag clutch in it. So when it hooks, it hooks. And so, you know, you're just on your knees over an engine. You're feeling the heat come off of the headers. You're smelling the fuel.
Oh, that fuel.
Yeah.
I do like that.
And I run high octane race fuel in there. And so you're holding, I think I hold throttle right around 4,000 RPMs, and just you crouch down, the number board goes from 3 to 2 to 1, and the 1 goes sideways and the flag drops, and you just dump the clutch, and it's so exhilarating. You feel like Superman, because I don't really see the rig, because I'm kind of stretched out on it. I'll see like a little bit of the windscreen, and I'm consciously aware of my hands. But all you see in front of you is other sidecars. And, you know, you're only, I don't even think we're 2 feet off the track. Maybe 20 inches or so off the track. And so when the sidecars in front of you take off, they throw up rubber and bits of rock, and anything that's on the track sticks to their tires gets thrown up at you. And I don't run a front fender on mine. I mean, I got a front fairing, but I don't run a fender because I want as much air to hit my headers as possible. So you feel like little bits of rock and gravel and pebbles and rubber come up and hit your neck. It's a very visceral experience. You know, I can't speak to what it feels like as a passenger because it would be hard for me to give up that kind of control. But on takeoff, she is over my back, like over my lower back. Since you don't sit on it, your butt kind of sticks out. So she goes over my back and butt and grabs a handhold near my left leg. It's a right chair. So she's...
I grab your right on the right...
It's right, the left right. Chair, excuse me.
Yeah, it's the left chair, so I grab a handhold on the right side of the rib and the left side, but the right side is the most challenging one for me to actually get, and I finally figured out how to reach it.
Yeah.
Because I'm very small, Z. I just want you to know that.
So her body weight over my back kind of pushes me down, but it also puts weight over the back tire because we need that for traction. Otherwise, we just do a several hundred foot long burnout. Sometimes you do a several hundred foot long burnout anyway.
Yeah.
But it's just such a, I've done a lot of stuff. I'm in the process of building. I think the only other thing that'll be exhilarating is this, is I'm in the process of building a twin jet powered land speed racing sidecar, and it'll have, or I already have the jets. It's got 200-300-pound thrust pulse jets on it, which pulse jets were the jets that they used on the B-1 buzz bombs Germany did. And so they have they make an insane amount of noise, and then they pulse a bunch of explosions in it per second, like 200-something explosions per second or something. So that, I think, is going to be more exhilarating than the sidecar. But the sidecar is more fun because I get to do it with the person I love. So.
Yeah, the jet bike is going to be by yourself.
Yeah.
But I'll stand there and wave at you.
Hey, cheerleaders are valuable, too.
What's valuable?
Cheerleaders, people who stand on the side and cheer you on.
Oh, my God. We've got such a good cheering section.
Yes, we do.
I talk about motorcycles getting me through rough patches in life. I think the motorcycles are the mechanical component. You know, in the absence of motorcycles, it was friends that got me through rough patches in life. You know, friends and doing things outside. And for a long time, when I was fighting the neurological effects of Lyme and I didn't have a memory anymore, and, you know, I'd go do fun stuff like kayak or I'd fish, and I always videoed it, you know, with my phone or a GoPro, because I didn't know if I'd remember those things. And so, you know, those were things that got me out of probably a downward mental spiral. But what really made the difference was the people in my life. You know, it didn't have to be someone that came over and said, you know, because for a while I couldn't really drive. I couldn't really do a lot. My one friend, John, would come get me and take me fishing and stuff. And that was awesome. I'll never forget that stuff. But, you know, just a phone call from someone, you know, and say, hey, how you doing? You know, or what's going on? I had a buddy, Dave. He would stop by the house. Ironically, he and I got diagnosed with Lyme disease on the same day. But, you know, seeing Dave come over, or a phone call from someone, you know, as cheesy as it sounds, Facebook, you know, reconnected with a bunch of friends that I hadn't seen in years, and, you know, the distraction that came from that, and then adding the ability to get back on a motorcycle again was just the icing on the cake, you know. But I have to give a shout out to our cheering section, both, you know, through good times and bad. I've got another good friend, Bob. He's up in Massachusetts. He's someone that I really value highly for his advice and friendship. And, you know, sometimes when you're just getting hammered from all sides, someone calling and, you know, just talk to you for a few minutes, or someone's you can, you know, pour out your problems to that says, I get it, or I got your back or something, you know. And then on the racing side, it's so many people that follow us, and it's fun when we post pictures, like we race at Barber or something, and, you know, people come by the pits that we see every year at the races. Or the probably more fun part is people we've never met before, you know, that either follow us on Gearhead Racing.
That happens. Yeah.
That happens often.
Yeah, we actually had someone come with a poster-sized photo of us from that day.
Yeah.
And said, oh, we've been riding all around looking for you guys. Will you sign this? We had a picture made of you guys. You want to hang in our shop? We're like, okay.
Yeah.
That was kind of fun.
And then remember Andrew.
Raffensperger.
Yeah.
Oh, such a dear friend of ours. So we met him. We race mostly out of state. We don't race in Ohio. And I live in Ohio. I'm from Ohio. I've been here my whole life. And my friends and family don't get to watch us race because we're out of state. So I asked Paul, I said, how do you feel about racing at Mid-O this year? We'd have to join AMA and WIRA to race it. But at least my mom and dad and brother and some really good friends of mine could come watch us. He's like, yeah, okay, let's do it. So that was an incredible amount of fun, actually. It was only, how far away is that, an hour and a half from here?
Hour and change, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to do it next year, too. So if anybody's around Mid-O next year, we'll be racing.
Yeah.
June? I don't remember what it is.
I can't remember. Wasn't he in the stand?
Oh, yeah, so this friend of ours, Andrew, who I made friends with on Facebook a few years ago.
Oh, a couple years ago.
Yeah, a couple years ago. And I'd never met him. But he seemed friendly. He has a Moto Guzzi that he rides. He lives in New York. And he was standing in the stand, was it a stand kind of by the fence, cheering us on. He's like, go, Paul and Andrea. Well, my parents were standing right in front of him. And my dad turned around. He's like, oh, yeah, it's my daughter. Is that how it went?
I think so, yeah.
And her boyfriend. And they started talking. So they brought Andrew down to the pit so he could meet us. And he is just an outstanding human being, just a wonderful, lovely human being. I'm so glad he came to cheer us on. I think he was going anyway, but.
Yeah.
He especially wanted to cheer us on.
That's just cool, you know, because, you know, motorcycles bring people from all different walks of life together.
And all over the world.
All over the world, yeah. Oh, the guy from your gym?
Oh, yeah, the guy from my gym came down to Mid-O, and I said, he's from Korea, South Korea, and I said, hey, and I had my Yamaha XT there because we use that for a pit bike a lot. I said, just jump on my bike and ride around because there's so much to see at Mid-O for a race. It's enormous. It's too hard to navigate by foot. You really need some kind of pit bike.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I have a really dear friend, Louis Schmielder, in the Schmielder family. He's from the Netherlands, and he used to keep a Moto Guzzi in Arkansas all the time, and he'd come to the States and ride for 30 days and then fly back to the Netherlands again.
Yeah, I like that about bikes because, you know, it was the joke about the Harley people always face each other, you know.
Oh, not that.
I've got my, I just stole my Harley, but.
I still have one, but I make fun of them thoroughly.
Yeah. No, that's not nice.
I do it.
Come on. No, you know, it's just that, it's that two people that might not normally ever communicate or have anything to do with each other stop at the same gas station and talk about bikes. You know, that's pretty cool. You know, you have something in common. You're bunk a biker, you know. You couldn't do that with bunk a Chevrolet. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You couldn't say, oh, if you own a Chevrolet, you know, join this bunk a Chevrolet program. And if you got a Chevrolet, you can, there's all these people that have Chevrolets that want you to stay with them. You know, it just doesn't work that way, you know. But with motorcycles, it's different.
So one more little tidbit, if I may.
You may.
After we raced Kershaw, Paul said, how do you feel about two-wheel racing?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I've never done it, but I would love to. I've always wanted to. I lived by Nelson Ledges Racetrack for 20 years. I've been by it my entire life. I would love to race. I always fantasize about racing two wheels on a track. He said, well, I have this KTM.
No, I bought a KTM from Tom Crump.
Oh, okay. Since we met.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. He bought the KTM. He said, I've got this KTM. Why don't you come up to New Hampshire and race it? Join USCRA and take the race school. And I was like, okay. So I flew up to New Hampshire. I must have left for the weekend because we had school. And school was like Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Yeah, you had to take race school.
I had to take race school. So I flew up to New Hampshire, took race school on the KTM, had a blast. Oh, my gosh. It was like something that had been missing in me my entire life, so much different than sidecar racing because now I'm piloting this little motorcycle.
And Tom gave me a good deal on it too. He's another really good friend. It's a race bike, stock motor, suspension works. It was set up basically for someone's rain bike. And so it's the RC390 KTM, really good handling bike, and he had some suspension work to it. So I've got vintage bikes, but I didn't feel comfortable with, you know, I think it'd be harder for her to start on a vintage bike. So Tom gave me a good deal on this thing. So that was a good bike for her to start on, because with a short inseam, it's both her feet can touch the ground too.
Nah, not really. Lean it to the left a little bit.
Okay.
But it's tall a little bit. It's a fun bike. So I raced a couple times. I raced that weekend, and then, oh, this is funny. So then I flew back on a Monday morning. I flew back, landed in Cleveland or Akron. I can't remember which one I flew into. Got to work by like 10 o'clock that morning. Still managed to go to work. Left Tuesday night and rode my Moto Guzzi back to New Hampshire for a Moto Guzzi rally that was in New Hampshire, the National. I rode straight back to Paul's place, remember?
Yep.
And then we went to the Moto Guzzi rally. And then I rode my bike home. That was fun. Because I just left New Hampshire. I was back for one day and then rode my Moto Guzzi back up there. That was fun. And then I ended up buying a 1973 Honda CB350.
Yeah.
And when did you buy that?
I bought it January or February? Colorado West. Oh, that's a good question. It might have been January. A friend of ours, Mark Dasher, tagged me in a post on Facebook, and because I buy and sell vintage motorcycles too, and it was a 73 CB350 set up for road racing.
Already set up, everything already safety wired and ready to go on the track. So
good tires,
mm-hmm.
New engine, good looking little bike. So I told Andrew, I'm like, hey, you know, if you want your own race bike, hint, hint.
Yeah. Well, I said, I don't think so. I really want to spend the money. So he showed up at my house with it and took it off your truck.
No, it was still on the truck. You're like, can I sit on
it? I said, can I sit on it? So he said, yeah. And then he says, do you want to buy it? And I said, yeah. So I bought it, and now I race that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I really appreciate you guys sharing these stories. I think a lot of people will relate to how motorcycles have gotten them out of dark times as well.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's not just the immediate act of being on that motorcycle. You know, because there's going to come a day, I know that there's going to come a day that I won't be able to ride anymore, you know, and I'm not looking forward to that day, but I'm not dreading it either, you know, because I've got all these memories and experiences, you know, going back a lot of years, you know, I could tell stories about, you know, I had an Amen Savior frame. Somehow we jammed the Ironhead Sportster in it, and I rode that thing to Sturgis, and I rode it to Florida and to Michigan from Tennessee, and did, I think they call it outlaw camping now. We just called it saving money back then, you know. I camped in medians and behind churches, and, you know, those memories are very much so present, you know, and I love the river vagabond lifestyle. I couldn't right now, you know, and I don't know if that's a possibility, but, you know, when I did do that, those are good memories, you know, and I don't feel the need to recreate those memories. I can draw on them, and, you know, there's going to be a day that I can't ride anymore, and I'll draw on all the memories and pictures and Facebook posts and, you know, stuff from all those years. Andrew can remind me of stuff, and, you know, my life will still be rich, you know, it'll still be fun. And this last year I started a motorcycle adventure company in West Virginia, and so, you know, I'm making, what do they call that, a lifestyle business or something, you know, that I found something I enjoy, and, you know, between transporting motorcycles and doing guided tours, hopefully I've got several more years in me, and my life's just getting richer by the day, you know, because I'm doing someone I love, and we both love the same stuff, and it so happens to be motorcycles involved in it, you know.
I hope I get to come out and see you in West Virginia one of these days.
Well, you better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the riding over there for like dual sport riding is, we've done a lot of that. And we actually camp off our bikes too when we're doing that.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be just dual sport. I mean, there is gobs and gobs and gobs of asphalt roads with views that are just stunning. And there's roads like Peach Orchard 19/8. It's so curvy, you can like slap yourself on the back going around a turn. You know, and so it doesn't necessarily have to be off-road or adventure bike. You know, my Moto Guzzi 1400 is a California is a street bike. You don't take that thing off anything. You leave it on asphalt. You could pick it up if it fell over. But that thing just loves just gobbling up curvy roads. You know, and so West Virginia has more people, more population in the U.S. than any other state within a day's driving distance. And in my opinion, it's got some of the most beautiful roads this side of the West. And if you decide you want to come out there, we'll put you up. Hopefully have a treehouse done on my property before next spring. And I'm a new biker host, Primitive Camping right now. But
hey, we really need them in West Virginia. There's not a lot of hosts there.
I noticed that, and it's like, you know, I'm hoping to have more amenities to offer. I'm right in the middle of building a 2-story, 24x48 shop, and I'm gonna put a bathroom in it and a shower in it, you know, so anyone that comes by can have more than just water and electricity in a tent camp spot. And, you know, I'm a mile from the Transamerica Trail. I mean, that's, you know, an iconic trail in itself. You know, you would need a dual sport or an adventure bike to do that. But anyone that wants to come as a guest is more than welcome. You and AJ definitely hope to see you out there. And you're always welcome up here in Ohio, too.
Always.
Thank you. I hope to really cross paths with you guys sometimes. I'd love to come watch a race.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Well, if you follow the ARMA schedule, A-H-R-M-A, we try to hit 3 or 4 races. But we'll be in Roebling Road in February. We'll have to see about Kershaw in March. And then we're always at Barber, right outside of Birmingham, Alabama, which has a massive, I think the largest motorcycle museum in North America is at Barber.
It's
so we did Barber in October.
Mm-hmm.
First or second weekend in October.
Oh,
it just depends. But you come out there to that, Z, and come into the pits. And we'll crank up sidecar and we'll take you and AJ around on it.
Sweet. That'd be awesome.
And if you ever decide you want to race, I know someone that'll sell you a sidecar.
Well, thank you guys for being on the show. Thanks for sharing. And thank you for sharing the story. It's very inspiring.
Well, thank you. And
yeah, thank you for having us.
And thank you for, you know, not only for having a podcast, but Bunker Biker. That's just such a, I first heard about it a few years ago. I'm like, holy crap.
What
like,
a great
such
tool.
A, novel idea. And you know, you hear about something like that, you wonder how it'll work out, but I follow the Facebook page and it works out, you know, and I'm looking forward to having my first guest. So
oh, and tell her about Gearhead on Facebook.
Oh yeah, if you want to follow us racing, it's Gearhead, G-E-E-R-H-E-D racing.
Awesome. And send me some links and some pictures and I'll put them in the show notes too, and if people want to find you, that might be a little easier for them.
Well, gee, that'll be awesome. We're always looking for new people to share experiences with. So,
well, I hope you guys have a great evening.
Yeah, you too.
You too.
Take care, Z.